This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
We don't know a lot about the events that took place that fateful day on June 27th. We do know that during the course of the afternoon, John Taylor would sing a tune that had been recently introduced to Nauvoo, a poor wayfaring man of grief.
That's next on the Joseph Smith Papers.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
June the 27th, 1844, Carthage, Illinois. Joseph and Hiram Smith, Willard Richards and John Taylor, languished in jail. The afternoon heat and humidity were oppressive, and the mood of the prisoners was noticeably subdued. And then, Elder Taylor began to sing.
A poor wayfaring man of grief hath often crossed me on my way, who sued so humbly for relief that I could never answer nay. I had not power to ask his name, where to he went or whence he came. Yet there was something in his eye that won my love, I knew not why.
Little did I think he realize that that song would be forever connected to the martyrdom that would take place later that day. And it stands in a sacred place to Mormons today. If you remember, by 3 or 4 in the afternoon, he would sing the first time of his own accord. I can almost picture him looking out the bedroom window as he would sing it almost to himself. And then just shortly before, a mob would attack that ill-guarded jail, Hiram would ask John to sing it again. And if you remember, John, by this time, he wrote later, right, that they were all pretty depressed. And he would say to Hiram, "I just don't feel much like singing." And Hiram would implore him, saying, "Come on, John, start and you'll get the spirit of it."
I warmed and clothed and cheered my guest and laid him on my couch.
That song is now sacred to Mormons. It's become a symbol of the martyrdom itself. Now, music is an integral part of Mormonism. But that tradition had a beginning long before Carthage, as a matter of fact, going clear back to 1830. It took time and it took revelation to establish that musical tradition that is now a part of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Tonight, we begin a 2-part series on the music of Mormonism in the ministry of Joseph Smith.
Michael Hicks.
When we talk about music in the church, we usually begin with the revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 25, in which Emma is told not really so much about music as told, as I recall, "It shall be given thee to make a selection of hymns, sacred hymns for use in my church, as it shall be given thee." That phrase is repeated. And then you have this statement that the song of the righteous is a prayer unto me.
Karen L. Davidson.
The date of this revelation is a significant thing to me because it answers a hypothetical question, which is, are hymns important to our Father in heaven? How important are they? Well, the date of this revelation is July 1830. In other words, only 3 months after the church was organized. And in my mind, that means that our Father in heaven puts a pretty high priority on hymns.
At the time the church was organized in April of 1830, music in church was a matter of debate. Now, there were some religious organizations that used music, hymns and singing, but there were others where to them, singing and or the use of instruments was at the least inappropriate, or at worst, it was evil.
This is a small group of saints, and the big question that was answered by that revelation was there would be hymn singing in the church. That was not a given in churches of the time at all. But groups like Alexander Campbell's Disciples of Christ, or Church of Christ, I guess it was, they did not believe in singing in church really at all. And the Quakers, of course, didn't sing. I mean, it was not clear that singing was going to be part of the worship of this new church. And one of the issues was, as with many things in the church, to what extent is this a restoration of practices of the Old Testament or the New Testament? We want this to be pure. And, of course, the only models around were other churches. And so Emma was told, you're going to make a selection of hymns to be had in the church. And that was saying something. But it was also not saying certain other things, like what about instruments in church?
Doctrine and Covenants, section 25, verse 11. And it shall be given thee also to make a selection of sacred hymns as it shall be given thee, which is pleasing unto me to be had in my church.
She didn't need to come up with a hymn book that was all by Latter-day Saint authors and composers. She could select hymns. And that made a lot of sense, I think. At that time, no one had grown up in the church. Every member of the church had been a member of another denomination and had favorite hymns already from that other denomination. And these hymns would have meant something to them, and they would have wanted to continue singing them. So Presbyterians loved their Presbyterian hymns, former Methodists loved those hymns, and she was instructed to select hymns. But she also was anxious to have what she called hymns of Zion. So when her little hymn book was published in 1835, this is a reproduction, reprint, about half of them were already existing hymns by well-known writers like Isaac Watts, and about half of them were new ones by Eliza R. Snow, Parley P. Pratt, a lot of hymn texts by William W. Phelps, but this was a mixture, about half and half, between new hymns, hymns that were already in existence. And in her preface to her 1835 hymn book, there is a statement by Emma that refers to, until we are more copiously blessed with the songs of Zion. So almost implying that she expected indigenous texts and tunes to kind of take over. But I'm glad that didn't happen. I think we are richer for the hymns that we can share with other denominations. Some of the texts we have sort of adopted as our own aren't by Latter-day Saint writers. For example, For the Strength of the Hills, that author had not heard of the Latter-day Saints, probably. And the tune for We Thank Thee, O God, for a Prophet is not by a member of the church.
There are documents that establish that Emma Smith had some ability with music, though to what extent is not known. We know that she loved to sing and that she had participated in choirs before she married Joseph Smith. This is one of the original 1835 hymn books that contains Emma's hymn selections.
There was a non-Latter-day Saint scholar who was commenting on this 1835 hymn book, and he said, the thing about Emma Smith is she may not have had a lot of training in poetry or in music, but Emma Smith knew a good hymn when she saw one. We know this is true because out of the 90 hymns in her original 1835 hymn book, 27 of them are still in our 1985 hymn book. That's almost a third, and that's a tremendously stable hymn tradition. Any present-day Latter-day Saint who thumbs through the 1835 hymn book will see a lot of old friends. We have The Spirit of God Like a Fire is Burning. We have the wonderful Edward Partridge text, Let Zion in Her Beauty Rise. And we have two hymns by Eliza R. Snow. And some of our very favorites are in the very first hymn book.
Music is a powerful religious tool. It was intended from the very beginning that the hymns of Mormonism would reflect the doctrines and the practices of the church. Hence, we see why Emma took such care and concern in the hymns she selected. With that in mind, we also understand why hymns and their usage over time may change.
Emma chose from the best that she could find. The church's concerns do change over the decades, and we need texts that reflect what we are most dealing with, what are the most important issues and engagements of the church at the present time. But concerns change. So our 1985 hymn book has more hymns about temples, families, and we don't let converts feel that we don't make converts feel that they must uproot themselves and come to the United States anymore. So those hymns would be removed. Others about our present day activities would be substituted.
Emma's hymns, without music of course, first began to be printed in 1832 in Independence, Missouri, in the church's newspaper, The Evening and the Morning Star. It was edited by William Wines Phelps.
Phelps, however, had his own literary interests, and we know that he revised, or as he was told to do later on, by High Council, to correct the hymns that Emma had selected. What that seems to have meant to Phelps was that he would make them sound more Mormon, which is to say, he would change things that were in the first person singular into first person plural. So, for example, it seems that Emma selected the song, O Thou in Whose Presence My Soul Takes Delight, on whom for a blessing I call. Well, Phelps' version of this was Redeemer of Israel, our only delight, on whom for a blessing we call. And so all of the original lines in Joseph Swain's hymn, O Thou in Whose Presence My Soul Takes Delight, they become we lines. They're about us as a community. We don't know that Phelps really knew music per se at all, because hymns meant texts to be sung, and the tunes were a different story. So when hymns were published, it was texts that were published.
As you may have recognized at the beginning of the show, when James Walker sang A Poor Wayfaring Man of Grief, the tune was different than the one we're most familiar with. Now, we'll tell you more about that hymn later. But that practice of singing a hymn using different tunes was more common than not.
Present-day Latter-day Saints think that a set of words and a tune are together for all eternity. There's just a one-to-one correlation of a hymn text and a hymn tune. This isn't the way earlier saints and other earlier Christian denominations thought. They had words. The words were the predominantly important thing. And then any tune that people generally knew that matched the meter of the words would be decided on, and you could sing the same words to any one of several different tunes. So we don't know in most cases what the most common tunes would have been for singing these texts from the 1835 hymnal. But they could trade around, they could make choices.
You know, someone writes the words and they get the music from somewhere else. usually music that's familiar or easy to learn. And so it's not unusual, is what I'm saying, for the Latter-day Saints to have done that. But that is how it was done. And it was only later that people began talking about writing our own music for these, our own words. And there were many people trying to do that, trying their own versions of things. And some tunes, we don't quite know where they came from. The great example there is The Spirit of God. We know that Phelps intended it to be sung to a tune called The American Star. We know that that tune was in use at least as early as 1844, because it was actually published in an LDS hymnal, the first LDS hymnal with musical notation in it, published in Bellows Falls, Vermont in 1844. And then it didn't appear again for many years thereafter.
So if hymn books were scarce or non-existent, how could the saints have participated in congregational singing, especially when there were no pianos or organs to accompany them?
The way hymns were usually sung in churches at that time was through a process of lining the hymns, or lining out, because people didn't know the words. They didn't have hymn books, and, you know, in the earliest days, and even when they had hymn books, not everyone had a hymn book. And they didn't have ones that were in the pews. You had one in your pocket, so you saw a hymnal. It was a little thing like that. It had the words, and it had the meters written, so you could tell, is it this kind of tune or that kind of tune. And typically, and particularly with a lot of new converts who didn't know any of these new things, the song leader would have to sort of chant the words, and then everyone would sing the first line, and then chant the next line, and so on. That was the way it was done for really many decades, well into the 19th century. And there was a lot of debate about that, because some people felt that that was sort of breaking up the hymns, and some people felt that you shouldn't even let congregations sing hymns. It should just be choirs or soloists, because congregations were going to mangle them. You had others like Alexander Campbell who were opposed to having hymn books because they felt that you shouldn't be looking at a page of man-made words singing to God. I know that sounds strange, but there were lots of different ways. You know, people at that time were pursuing purity in religion.
The dedication of the Kirtland House of the Lord was another watershed moment in establishing the musical tradition of Mormonism. It was there, for the first time, that Joseph Smith called for a choir.
Now, first, he organizes a singing school in Kirtland. And he has a teacher, a recent convert to the church, suddenly becomes the singing school master. Now, the original papers on this say that Joseph says in his journal, after some altercation, a judicious arrangement was made to have a singing school. He says, after some altercation. I think that this was a big deal. This was not, oh yeah, let's have a singing school. I think this was taking a step towards organizing a choir, and that was really questionable with a lot of people, I'm sure. I think that it really was a question about, are we not departing from this pure New Testament tradition and going back to the European state church traditions by having a choir? So he organizes or has this singing school be organized, and there is a singing school master who is training the choir for the Kirtland Temple dedication. Now, how they sang, we don't really know. What they sang, as far as the tunes go, we know a little bit. We know all the words, because those were carefully taken down in the minutes. And that's a good thing, because that was not typical. And beyond that, not a lot known. And by the way, the singing master, Marvel Chapin Davis, M.C. Davis, sort of disappears from church history from then on.
When the saints were in Nauvoo, the success of the missionaries brought in converts from around Europe and especially Great Britain. Now, as you might expect, these Brits brought with them a deeply entrenched musical tradition of their own.
The big changes for Mormon hymnody came about when you had these waves of British converts coming into the church for two reasons. First, they believed in choirs, typically, and a little bit more formal kind of musical tradition. They also were more accustomed to instruments in church. I mean, even the state churches from which many of them had come, you know, would have instrumental ensembles and so on. And they had a different way of thinking of things. I'll give you an example. You mentioned the hymn by Phelps, Praise to the Man. Phelps wrote the words to Praise to the Man to be sung to the tune Star in the East, which was actually a Christmas carol. But it has a very plaintive, mournful I'll sing it to you. I'll sing Phelps's words to the tune to which he seems to have intended it. Praise to the man who communed with Jehovah, Jesus anointed, that prophet and seer. And so on. Then the chorus is, Hail to the prophet ascended to heaven, traitors and tyrants now fight him in vain. And so on. Well, that's the kind of tune you would have for a mournful funeral of the prophet. Yeah. And the way people felt, it was a tragic thing. Well, British immigrants coming into the church are thinking of the church as newness and triumph and joy. And so they're singing that, praise to the man who communed with Jehovah. They're thinking of the greatness of the prophet looking back and all that he accomplished. And for Phelps, it was loss and the sorrow of this thing. And one more setback for the saints. Yeah. The tunes make a big difference. And to some extent, that particular case is a great example of the ways in which some saints, and in this case Phelps, could look at texts and how they might be sung versus the British immigrants who are coming in, and this is the new world for them. Yeah. And it's not loss, it's a new beginning. Their notion of what they were coming to was a very hopeful one and very positive and optimistic. So you take that aspect of these British trained musicians coming in and bringing their instruments with them and their instrumental and cultivated musical traditions with them, and the hymnody of the church changes a lot.
In typical Latter-day Saint meetings today, a congregation will sing and pray to open a meeting and then sing and pray to close it. Now, given all that we've said about early Mormons seeking their own way, how did such a tradition get started?
You know, we learned how to have meetings by looking at what other churches did. The idea of having a prayer and then a song or vice versa and then a sermon, you know, after both of those, that's sort of a Methodist way of doing things. And other churches too. But there would not be someone who would come up and be the chorister, and there wouldn't be someone playing an instrument to accompany either. I want to say that that tradition, again, would have been something that came in through the waves of British immigrants, as would be the use of instruments and choirs, absolutely. There's no question that Joseph Smith really valued having people from the old church traditions come and join his new church and bring with them, in effect, the sophistication, the cultivated traditions.
The tabernacle organ in Salt Lake City, well, that's an icon of Mormonism. Today, organs and pianos are an established part of LDS meetings. But the way they first entered the church, well, that may not be what you would expect.
Instruments in worship meetings didn't come in the way you might think. They came in through the militia. Because there was no instrumental tradition, as I say, in the meetings of the church. The question of instruments was a tricky one because on the one hand, you would have people pointing to the genealogy of Cain and saying, saying, if you look at the genealogy of Cain, it mentions Jubal, who's a descendant of Cain, you know, and he is the father of all such as handle the organ, as I recall. And so, in other words, that was a tradition that went back to the lineage of Cain. Well, that anti-instrumental bias went right through into Joseph Smith's day. Well, here's what happened. The Nauvoo Legion band initially was a fife and drum corps, which is what a militia band would be. And it also had a few others, people who could play, and you know, there was a clarinet, and there were occasionally a fiddle might come in, you know. But that's where instrumental music was. It was a military thing. William Pitt's band gets converted, his brass band, him and his group. They come over to Nauvoo, and of course, suddenly these are trained musicians with a brass band. How do they fit in? Well, there was a lot of discussion about how they would fit in with the Nauvoo Legion. So Joseph creates a second cohort of the band, the Nauvoo Legion Band Cohort 2, which is run by William Pitt, and it's the brass band. And when Joseph wants a group to play for some ceremonial occasion, he gets that band to play. Ceremonial occasions would include temple dedication, Masonic Hall, things that were religious in nature, and here's the military band playing there. That's where you really get, I would say, the sanctification of instruments in LDS worship. It's through the militia, and specifically through William Pitt's band. At some point, though, and it really was in the 20th century, the organ became the official instrument of the church for church meetings.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, more about hymnals, hymns, and those who wrote them, as well as what we promised, a closer look at Carthage. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
Just perishing for want of bread, I gave him all he blessed it break, and ate but gave me part again. Mine was an angel's portion then. For while I fed with eager haste, the crust was manna to my taste.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.